Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2006. Today's session is titled Current Muslim and Christian Issues, presented by Nellie Van Doren Harder. The number is VA-N2006-5. Let's listen in.
I was once asked, what do the women do? Because all the Islam we've been talking about Islam in Europe, Islam in the United States, a lot of it is really centered around the male figure. You know, extremists, it's mostly men you hear about. It is really the bottom line seems to be men of a certain age who call the shots. And it's as if Muslims have no other people in their populations. So the women, if we hear about them, they're suppressed. And the children you never really hear about. And so I started to make a PowerPoint about what is actually happening among the women and what are the different varieties of women that we find in the Muslim communities. And also, another reason I made this presentation is to show you that women are becoming very powerful. And then you understand immediately, because the whole week we went through aha moments. Now we understand why extremists are so hot about this or hot about that. Remember, what did we end yesterday? What was the hot topic?
The prom, right.
Mm-hmm. Morals, right? Oh my gosh, if the morality is starting to sink, and you know, then the whole community will collapse. Now, why is, when you have extremist discourse or extremists trying to take over in certain countries, think Afghanistan. We all know the famous example of Afghanistan. Why do they immediately zoom in on the women? Because there is so much changing among the perspectives of the women, among the perceptions, among the voices of the women, and women, and this is the most important, women themselves are starting to study the Quran and the holy texts. Remember, the Quran and tradition, and women themselves are standing up and saying, like we saw yesterday, Amina Wadud. Remember, Amina Wadud, who wrote a book where she explains the Quran from a woman's point of view. Well, there's nothing more dangerous than that for an extremist. And so this is just to show you the scala of the spectrum of women and women's movements we have in the Muslim world, and also to show you that a lot of women are very active in the battle against extremism. Okay, we can have the next one. And I thought I'll start with some pictures, the different ways how women can wear the veil. And the one that is not on it is the one that you see a lot in, if you go to Asia, which is just a loose veil. And the next picture, I've just now shown you a few pictures. But these, for example, are both Muslim women leaders who became activists for peacemaking based on their reading of the Quran. And they are in the Philippines, where you might know there's a huge conflict going on between the Catholic population, the Catholic government, and part of the Muslim community. These women, well, they look lovely, they look, you know, totally unthreatening, harmless. They are power blocks, I tell you, what they are doing in the Philippines. But their work goes back to what they read in the Quran. You see their Muslim Women Workshop Conference, peace advocates, and I don't know what they say on that. Yeah, the next one. This is just a picture of the Netherlands. Being in the West doesn't mean that you are advanced or progressive. We have talked about that too, remember? That this picture are two women in the burqa. This is called the burqa. And actually, every journalist in the Netherlands is asking, should they wear the burqa or not? And I say, go ahead, you get hit by a bike. Because you can't see a thing when you wear this. You know, you're just like a blind person. And so if they really want to make that statement, let them do it. And so this is a picture from the Netherlands, and then the next picture is from the US, and this is my favorite. Fatima Aisha Khomeini from Princeton, New Jersey. Well, you know what is so strange about this picture? This is forbidden in most Muslim countries. In most Muslim countries, you cannot have a driver's license or a passport without your face showing. So because remember we talked about the liberties that we have in the West, open societies, the freedoms of expression, things are possible there that are absolutely forbidden in lots of Muslim countries. Because in Egypt and in Syria and Lebanon, and before they realize, this Fatima might be a Mohammed. Or an Omar, and it has happened in Cairo. There were purse snatchers dressed in a burqa, and it turned out they were men. And they realized they were men because of the way they were walking.
Okay. Was she smiling in this photo?
She might be slightly smiling. That is very observative from you.
I bet her eyes are brown.
Now these are Muslims too, and this is what this is one of my favorite pictures because in Islam it says cover your shame, and then because that the veil comes from the teaching in the Quran that says cover your shame. Now the problem is nobody knows what the shame is and where it is. Where does it begin? Where does it stop? Does it include the hair? Nobody knows. Now in Bali there are women who said, well, it means covering the hair. Well, they are covering the hair, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they're perfectly in tune with the Islamic rules. Yeah? And I just wanted to show you also that Muslim women find all kinds of solutions to, for example, you hear about this debate, they cannot do sports because then they expose the body, and so forth, and so forth. Well, in Iran, a lot of women have started to design sports outfits, especially for women, that you are completely covered. And you see, for example, women swim in like what we would see as a diver's suit, and then something on the head, made of rubber, and you're covered. So and then you can swim. So women themselves are coming up with all kinds of solutions. And this is I forgot where this one is, but this is the soccer team. A women's soccer team, and I forgot which country this is, probably from Iran. And, this is just a picture that where you see there's a big demonstration going on and they are temporarily stopping so that they can pray. And here, now here are the dangers of the future. These women, I took this picture in a madrasa, in a Quran school in Indonesia. These people are preparing for their exam where they will show that they have learned the Quran by heart. And that they will also show that they learned how to interpret it. They know all the interpretations. They do not use their own interpretation, but they have learned what the interpreters, let's say, in the history of Islam, all have said about certain verses. And they will do a public exam, which is a public, and the exam is as follows. They will go on the stage, they will come to the mic, and if this would be the audience, one of you can stand up and say, I want to hear Quran verse, Quran chapter 4, verse 16 through 24, and they will give it to you. And then the community will judge if they were correct, if they made mistakes, and then someone else will stand up and say, and now I want to know Quran 5, verse 1 through 16, what does it mean? What are the main explanations for that verse? And so that's how the exam is taken. I know, it's a nightmare in the Western world. But this person will know the Quran. She's young, she's a woman. She will know the Quran, she will know it by heart, she will know the interpretations, and she will start to teach it. And the interpretations that she knows, she can process by her own experience with her own communities, and she might come up with something very different. And again, extreme danger, high alert. Okay, the next one, please. Thank you. All these developments, I don't know if you got up in October 2005 last year and thought, this is a month different from all other months. Like in Melissa's class, we study about drama, we still have to think about, constantly have to think about what makes this day different from all other days. Well, what made the month of October in 2005 different from all other months? There was a huge conference in Barcelona, and it was the first international conference or conference on Islamic feminism. This had never happened in the history of Islam. The fact that there was this conference means there is a body of women who can meet and who can discuss their findings and their ideas. And their main conclusion is that Muslim women denounce sexist interpretations of the holy texts. That is the main point of departure. And I, for anybody who wants to go on their website, I gave it here. Maybe we can have the next one. And just to show you, there were women from Mali, from Catalonia, which is in Spain, right? Nigeria, Indonesia, Malaysia, Egypt, from all over the Muslim world. The only ones missing, of course, were from Saudi Arabia. But from all over the Muslim world, there were women who considered themselves feminists based on the Islamic scriptures. Now, these, I just want to show you these, that this is not totally new. These women are building on groups that have been around for a long time. This picture was taken in 1917. And it's in a picture from Indonesia, and you see it's a very bad photograph, or what do you want, 1917. But this is these three women were the first leaders of a women's organization in Indonesia. And from there, those started to learn the Quran, to recite the Quran, and teach women about the Quran, which was a huge step. And we can go to the next picture. These are the ones that are the descendants of these three women who are continuing the organization. And in Indonesia, these two have become social activists and activists for human rights. And again, they read the Quran in the light of human rights. What does it say? You know, that is universal. What does the Quran teach that all of us can agree about? And that does not put down anybody, and it's not harmful for anybody. Yeah? Oh, and this is the granddaughter of one of the three. I just thought, but you see, the rebel rousers, the revolutionaries, the dangerous elements don't look anyway as we would imagine them. They are very demure women, complete, you know, dressed as they should be according to Islamic rules, and they try to fit in, and they try to change things from the inside, mostly in very gentle ways. Because they realize if you do what Amina Wadud did, some of you maybe were not here yesterday, Amina Wadud, who started to lead the prayer for men and women in New York, the Muslim woman, if you do you go too far and too quick, and you will lose followers. You have to do it step by step. Okay, so what were the main conclusions of the Barcelona conference that all Muslim feminist women can agree on? That Islamic feminism is reality. There's no way back. And it is based on the revelations of the Quran and on the conviction that the Quran does not justify patriarchalism. Is that a word?
Yes.
Okay. And it also says Islam can change women's status. Remember we talked about how dangerous secularists are considered? How dangerous it is to fall away from the teachings of the Quran and from the teachings of Islam. So if you say, I am staying in Islam and I believe it can liberate me, then you remove that huge danger by which you completely deflate anybody who might want to attack you for being a feminist. You see? So, and then it wants to help laws that discriminate against women, and that is a huge battle. Because this battle is going on in Nigeria, in Indonesia, in Egypt, and all kinds of countries where there are Muslim majorities or where there's a large Muslim community, where they want to start to introduce laws that actually want to make women into secondary citizens, just as, you know, the women and the Christians, remember, and the non-Muslims become secondary citizens. Women, so what does it mean? It means that these kind of movements also have great consequences for Christians and Jews living in Muslim lands. Because if women can stop certain laws for women, they will also stop them for non-Muslims. And this is very important. And then the idea is, who were the ones who made the laws? Men. Right? Men made the laws, not women. And women are the ones who have to suffer them. And that should change. But they're also very brilliant. One, I don't know if the gentleman who said at lunch that he couldn't come because this was on women. Is he here? Because they realize that if you alienate the men who, you know, have a tradition of 1400 years to say what they want about the Quran, then your cause is lost. So you have to include as many men as you can, as many interpreters of the Quran as you can. Yeah. And so Muslim feminism seeks justice for men and women based on the Quran. That's it. And I will not go through all of these, but the point of departure is also the third one, that the Quran, yes, there's a lot in there that is, you know, seems to suppress women, seem to make women secondary to men, but the Quran also said that we are all made from one spirit, from the same spirit. And that is very important to remember. So if we're made from the, created from the same spirit, what's your problem, right? Then we should be equal. And then they look to other verses in the Quran. One verse states that in their religious duties, in the practice of religious duties, both men and women are the same. That there's no, that when you die, God will not say, you were a woman, you should have done this. No. You followed your prayer schedule, you read the Quran, you studied it, you took it seriously, you will be judged for that. And there will be no male or female there. And that's the Quran says as well. And finally, in that whole discussion about that men in the marriage are the ones who, you know, who are what they call the protectors of the women, who are the guardians of the women, which means in reality that women in some countries cannot travel without the permission of the husband. Some countries, for example, a woman cannot visit her family without his permission. She cannot see, and this can lead to incredible situations. I've met women who haven't seen their brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers for 5-6 years because they happened to marry a nasty guy who said, you can't go, you see? So they look at that too. They know this reality. So I think, you know, coming back to what Jody has been teaching us, like, you have to look at your assets. What is there? Well, they look at what is happening in real life. Because what the men do, I don't want to insult all the men in this audience, but what the men have done, the rules they made, the laws they made, are almost like floating over communities. They're not based in real life. You see, so what women come up with, they look at real life. What are the issues? What are the problems? And those you start to address. And from there you work up and try to change laws and try to change systems. So one very important verse is where it says in the Quran that men and women are each other's garments. So you cover each other, you protect each other, you defend each other. You do not go and tell that one lords it over the other. You see? That is the bottom line. Okay, I keep going, as you see, but are there any questions or remarks or things you want to say? Or we can all follow me? Yeah?
Where do women get the money to do what they want to do?
Very interesting question. Often they have nothing. These organizations or these movements or these groups of people, they very often start with nothing. They just get together and say, we have to do something. And money is the least, you know, this happens a lot in countries where most of the people are not that rich. You go to Indonesia, the majority of the population is quite poor. So these people are used to work with what they have. So again, they see, what do we have? Okay, we have here a room in the house of someone where we can meet. We have a Quran, right? We have maybe a notebook. You start with what you have and you go on from there. And then the idea is often that things will come. And then I must say that groups that became significant voices in society, they would then attract money, for example, by Ford Foundation. A lot of the initiatives in places like Indonesia have then, you know, subsequently be given money by the Ford Foundation so that they could publish their findings, that they could get, they could organize conferences, or that they could travel to, for example, Barcelona. So they didn't start with finding the money. That's what I always found so remarkable. I said, we got to start, and there's no time to wait. You know, there's no time to lose. We have to go. Okay. We can go to the next one. This is what the women suffer from when you read the Quran. You know, that it says the men are the protectors and the maintainers of women. And it is this verse 434. The biggest headache on earth for women. That verse is where a lot of the suppression of women and the treatment of women is based on. It's on this verse. And then, you know, because people don't only look at the Quran, they don't only look at the text of the Holy Book. No, they also add a lot from the culture. They add a lot from the practices around them. So they come from an African tribe and they have this verse and then they connect that with what the African tribe tends to do, you know, concerning women. Do I make sense? So, and so that verse says that Allah has given one more strength than the other, and then you go on and on and on, and then it says that you can beat your women. Like. And lightly. And lightly is not in the Quran. This is the translation. This is a kind of a little note, an extra addition from the translator, by the translator. Not in the Quran. And last is not in the Quran either. And last year, I was still hot and fired up when we were at home. It was in August. Maybe you, does anybody remember this Muslim leader in Spain and the book he published on women? No? Oh, that was a big hype last year. But you see, we go from hype to hype, but there's so many, we forget about them so quickly. No, last year, there was, the beginning of 2005, there was a Muslim leader in Spain who wrote a book, a handbook, how to beat your wife. While in Spain, which is after all another, you know, another culture, and you might go to jail and blah blah blah, and some observant Spanish people found the book and then he went to jail for writing it, and it was forbidden. But the whole thing, basically, how can you beat your wife without showing it, you know, with getting away. Where do you beat? How hard? And think about it. A book, a handbook on beating your wife. Think about it. I was all fired up. You know? I was so mad. Anyway, but you see, that this is again, when we talk about Muslims in Europe, Muslims in America, this is again one of these issues. These issues like, okay, it's in the Quran. I'm taking the Quran literal, and I'm a man, and I can beat my wife if I want, but I happen to be in America where the police is very vigilant, and so are the neighbors, so what do I do? So you have to come up with all these different solutions, you see, and this was one of them, the book on the wife beating. Anyway, but this is the headache. If you think, I want a headache, what shall I think about thing 434? And then you have a headache. This is the headache of all Muslim women in the world, basically. Yeah. Okay, and this is what leads to. This is what leads to. Have you heard about that huge issue of the Saudi Arabian TV presenter who was beaten up so much that she ended up, well, there she is, you know. And here, say your prayers, her husband said. So he went, we were just playing the Newt Gingrich story with Melissa's class, the famous story where he visits his wife and asks, who is dying of cancer, and asks for a divorce. Well, this is what this man did. They went to the hospital, his wife is there, totally knocked out. Say your prayers, you know? But the thing was this, knowledge is power. She was a public figure on TV in Saudi Arabia. And he based himself on this verse that we just saw, But she also knew other verses, you know? So she said, she made it the case, and it came, it reached the national and the international press. And of course, I can't even start to describe the shame that came on the guy, and I'm not sure if the marriage lasted. But you see, this would have been impossible even 20 years ago in the Muslim world. She would have ended up in the hospital, she might have died, and nobody would have given a peep. That was the situation. When you hear about suppression, when you hear about women suffering, the suffering is also because of the system, the culture and the society around them. Nobody can, you know, help them. But again, Muslims being in Europe, Muslims being here, changes a lot, because you can't get away with this here. You can't. Someone will come to your house and ask you what happened to your wife. And, well, I'm not sure if you can say, well, she fell from the stairs and then rolled out a bit. I don't know, you know, but most people will not think that. So you see, Muslims moving to other countries is changing a lot back home as well. You know, because that's where they learn what happens here and think, why can't we do that? So this was a huge path-breaking issue, and it's of course, well, you see her, how pretty she is and what happened. Anyway.
Where was this publicized? I mean, where was this page? What was it out of?
It came out in Saudi Arabia, and then it came out in Middle East. This is a Middle East journal. Okay. It came out then in the press in the West, but the fact that it came out in Saudi Arabia was absolutely revolutionary. That was the kind, because we haven't spoken much about the honor of the family, of the man, right? This is something, when this comes out, it blemishes his honor. We have talked about honor killings, you see? Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I say, 20 years ago, this would not be possible. Mm-hmm. And now it is.
So, in these 20 years then, I'm assuming that the women who are coming together and reading the Quran and trying to come up with these other interpretations have men in their lives who are supportive or at least not against it. They allow them to do this. Otherwise,
they are or they are not.
Fathers, brothers,
they are or they are not. Yeah. Often there are many types of models. Some they are encouraged by their father or brothers, but sometimes not. Sometimes not at all. I know of women who learned the Quran in secret, mm-hmm. because their father did not want them to learn the Quran. Mm-hmm. Because he felt they could only learn certain parts, because he felt if they would know the whole thing, it would become a dangerous tool, and he was right, you see?
So do they risk physical harm from their families to do that and to speak out? Or?
Well, that's a very good question, because what they risk is this. If they go and they speak out based on the Quran, and if they are correct, and that's the key, if they are correct, nobody can say something against you. Because you are basing yourself on the holy text. And that is very important. Yeah? Okay, we can have the next step. I'm not sure if it's text or picture. Yeah, so we see what I said, that the rules and the role of women and the rules about it are based on the Quran, on the tradition, on the interpretations of the Quran, but also on the law. Much remember yesterday when we talked about the legal mindset and the non-legal mindset? The law is very important, because the law was shaped by between the 8th and the 10th century. And that law then went into societies, and societies kind of processed it in their own way. I can give you the most striking example is the marriage law. Do you know where the model for the marriage contract in Islam comes from? Who knows about that? Well, as Muslims were told by the Quran that they could have four wives and that they could be joined in marriage, they realized they needed a marriage contract. They didn't have that before the time of the Prophet Muhammad. So they started to think about how to draw up such a contract and what the rules should be, because they had no model for it. And so they looked to the closest contract that was, how do you say, similar to the marriage situation. Can you think what connection between people that could be? What could be, yeah?
Slaves.
Slavery, that's it.
Yeah.
slavery. And that is why we have all these rules in the marriage contract that the woman cannot apply for a divorce, because the slave cannot say, well, today I want to be free. It's a different day from all other days. I'm going to be free. A slave can never do that. So what? Basically, you buy a slave, you buy a wife. That's why you have the dowry. You buy, what you buy is also her services in the bed. You buy that. That's why you can kill her when she's found, you know, be someone else. You have bought her. It comes from the contract for slaves. And that is why, you know, in the law there are many elements that are based on the very early Arabic culture, and they no longer apply to modern life. And then these laws go into the culture. And in the culture they are hooked up with all kinds of, what can I say, old wives' tales, such as that women have only half a brain, and that's why they need protection. Mm. And that a woman, that, for example, my favorite is that there seems to be a tradition, but people have not really ever found it, that the majority of the inhabitants of hell are women who were disobedient to their husband.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So you see that mindset joins these laws and starts to live a life of its own, basically. And that is how you then get these very strange visions on women. Because, okay, you believe women have half a brain. And then you ask men, what do you mean? Has your mom half a brain? No. Your sister? No, she's quite smart. Who has half a brain? Well, everybody else, except for my wife, my mother, and my sister. Okay, well, what about the rest of the women? Yeah, well, they're, you know, they have half a brain. And don't you think that those men, don't they think about those women when they are their sister or their mother, that they are quite full and capable and aware? You see, it's so inconsistent and so illogic. But the fact that it is illogic has to be enlarged and drawn out and pointed out. So this culture, the Arab culture and the non-Arab culture, where Islam spread, are very important in shaping what is, you know, the cult about the rules and the attitudes towards women. Yeah, we can go to the next one. Now we come on something else. Why did women have to hide that they read the Quran, right? Because originally the idea was this. Remember the impurity of women? Originally the idea was anybody who's impure, which means women, dogs, cats, Christians, Jews, they cannot even touch the Quran. Women when they are impure, and everybody else because they're always impure. Right? Now, not being able to touch the Quran when you are menstruating means you can actually not learn it. Because you cannot, what happens if the Quran is in your head and you are impure? See? What then happens to that very pure book? That's people could not wrap their mind around that. So for, give or take, 1300 years, women never studied the Quran. They never engaged with the text of the Quran. So that's why it became such a male-oriented religion. Very, very similar to what happened in Orthodox Judaism, right? Women had no clue what they learned with the interpretations and the explanations of the man. Very much like in the pre-Reformation church when the priest would, you know, preach and he was the only one who read the Bible. So that was the case with women. They were not, because, you know, this holy book cannot be held by an impure person. And originally people didn't even feel they could interpret the Quran. Neither male nor female could interpret the Quran because it was such a holy text. It was straight from God. How could you interpret it? So what they started to do, and this is something most of us don't realize, the first 1300 years, a lot of the interpretation of the Quran was only grammatical. So people would sit and watch that, what does the article the mean in this context, you know, and they had endless discussions about that. So you see, this is no longer applied to real life. This becomes a text for the sake of a text. Linguists discussing with other linguists what the text means. And, you know, Arabic is a very rich language. And the language of the Quran is very rich. And it's very difficult. It's a very sophisticated language. And then you speak about the language. For example, just for the word elephant, you have, oh, geez, I forgot how many, over 90 words for the word elephant. Yeah, because an elephant can be 1 month old, 2 months old, 3 months old. An elephant can be pregnant 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. Oh. And you see, you have so many words to indicate what this elephant, what the position and place and situation of that elephant is. So that is why a lot of the words in the Quran are actually very ambiguous as well. You see, because what exactly was meant with this word? So they could go on and on about grammar forever. You know, have great pleasure with grammar, because there is so much that is to be decoded. Now, by the end of the century, by the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that system was broken down. Someone called Muhammad Abdi, you don't have to remember his name, he said, if we keep doing this, if we keep just looking at the grammar, which was, by the way, taught at the famous madrasa. Has everybody heard about the madrasa? Madrasas are in the news all the time. Have we heard about the madrasa, these Quran schools where the Taliban were trained and, you know, where extremists are trained? Well, this system that was taught in the madrasa, and whether you would go to a madrasa in Afghanistan, in Russia, or in Egypt, or in Saudi Arabia, they all had the same curriculum. Think about that. Think about that. I don't think we have anything comparable in the West. They had the same curriculum, they would learn the same. And so, women were, in all those countries, excluded, you see, because of the system. And so by the 20th century, this broke open, because some Muslim leaders realized that they were getting far behind the West. Mm-hmm. There they saw the colonial powers come in with trains and with you know, with cameras and with all kinds of devices they had never imagined in their lives, and they realized, oh, we have done this, studied the grammar of the Quran. We haven't studied math, we haven't studied physics, we haven't studied engineering. You know, we got to do something. So then they broke open the system and said, now we have to look at the Quran with different eyes, and we have to look at what does the text mean for the actual life. Wow, that was a huge breakthrough. And that was with the first openings for women. And then, you know, the picture I showed you from Indonesia from 1917, they could do that because of this development. Yeah, we can go to the next one, if you don't mind. Yeah?
What did Muhammad Abdu have to do with madrasa? I didn't understand.
Oh,
that
he broke the system of the madrasas. He said, you should stop teaching just grammar. You should look at the text. You should not just sit and fight over words. You should read the whole text.
So the study of the grammar is called the madrasa?
No, that was in the madrasa. The madrasa is the Quran school.
Okay.
Maybe you've read about it. The madrasas make the news a lot. That's why I mention them, because they are often, some of them are hotbeds for future extremists.
So I don't understand what madrasa has to do with Muhammad Abdul.
He broke the system of the madrasa.
Okay, I got it.
Because for 1300 years, the system was the same wherever you went.
Okay.
Yeah. So that is why Muslim countries were kind of lagging behind. You know, there were a lot of developments in the West, while in most of what were predominantly Muslim countries, nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody studied engineering and chemistry and. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for asking, because, you know, I see madrasa every time I open a newspaper, I see the word, but maybe I'm tuned into it. I'm attuned to it. Okay. So we have seen why the exclusion for women, uncleanliness. They were not welcome in the Quran schools, in the madrasa. And so they didn't get any education, because the only education was Quran education, so women had no education. Finished. And then you had the segregation of society. Men outside, women inside, or men in their own arena and women in their own areas. And that has to do with the division between public and private of what women and men can do. Yeah, we can go to the next one. And I might skip a few, because what did women do? And this is something to remember. You don't have to remember all this, but one thing you should remember is that women, because they were excluded from the official religion, they became practitioners of the unofficial religion, which is called the folk religion. And they would, you know, they would guide women. For example, in Egypt, you have graves of Muslim saints. And if you cannot get pregnant, what you do is you go to the grave and jump over it a few times. You see? And that was what the role of women would be to guide other women how to do that. And then they would make amulets, and they would make all kinds of magical texts that people could repeat. And women also would start to lead each other in all kinds of mystical practices. For example, in Egypt, you had a practice when someone is believed to be possessed by a bad spirit, by an evil spirit, then women will dance around and they will swirl around. Anybody has ever heard of that? Dzar? But with the beat of certain music, and while they're swirling around, you know, they get so dizzy. I think the idea is when you get dizzy enough, the spirit doesn't want to stay in you anymore and goes out. But you know, it becomes a real women affair, and it is not actually Islamic. This practice comes from Africa. It comes, you know, it's not just from the Middle East. It comes from all kinds of other places. So that is where often women became leaders of folk Islam. And they could be preachers for women, which means that they would teach women the rules. You see, what the rules of cleanliness, the rules of how to be a good housewife, and the morality rules. Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to behave? And there's huge handbooks for women. Huge handbooks saying how are you supposed to behave to your father-in-law, to your mother-in-law, to your brother-in-law, to your uncle, your aunt. The long lists of what your behavior should be, and what you should watch, and what you should not watch, and a long list of how to wash the dishes, how to sweep the floor. It's all in handbooks for women. So women would, you know, teach other women that kind of thing. And but now women have become interpreters of the holy text, and that is new. That's revolutionary. Yeah. And I just also thought, if you wonder how could this be, it's of course education. It is the general level of education that has become higher and higher for both men and women all over the world, right? And of course the healthcare. The same issues, the same elements that help our societies progress, you see that in Muslim societies. Birth control is a huge one. If you don't have to take care of 15 kids, but only two or three, you have your hands free for some Quran study. So you see there is, and of course, and again, that's why extremists don't like the West. Because the West stirs up these ideas that women can have rights, and that women can suffer, you see? And as I say, that in the US and Europe, there are these laws protecting them. You don't want that news to leak out. You see? So that's why experts don't like all this contact with the West. It stirs up trouble. Yeah.
Just jump in.
Yeah, and then let's just skip this, because the problem is that a lot of the abuse against women, like honor killings, like female genital mutilation, which I call circumcision of women, it's really cultural, it's local. It's not in the Quran. It's not in the tradition, it's local. So a lot of the things that we will go through were added later. And so, what I told you yesterday about the morality, the Sharia dictates, when you then have people who want to apply the Islamic law in a country and focus straight on the women and straight on the morality, right? That is, they immediately look at the position of women and what men and women do together. That is where the whole, you would say, people are poor,
people go through a tsunami, and I'll tell you in a minute why I put that there. People have all kinds of challenges in their lives. No. This is what are the most crucial issues when you look at the extremist discourse. Have you noticed that? Or is it just because I told you yesterday? Yeah? And that discourse, as I told you, has then become part of the hyper-Islamic discourse in a place like the US. Well, the tsunami. This is something that made all those who heard the story cry. We were at a small conference about Muslim women in Southeast Asia. And one woman from Aceh, you know the tsunami was in Aceh. And Aceh is a part of Indonesia where the Islamic law has been applied since a long time. And what that exactly means, nobody knows, because it's really like a tribal law. Nobody knows what it is, and certain scholars make it up as they go. And one scholar was asked about the tsunami, because now it has come out that 2/3 of the victims were women. Mm. Why? Because in the name of Islam, women, there was a law that women were forbidden to wear pants or shorts. Women could only wear skirts. Now, skirts in Indonesia are these sarongs that you wrap around yourself. And you know, my students, when I taught there, when they would graduate and they had to go on the podium, they would all have their sarong, and you can only walk, you know. Like you remember the Japanese geisha? That's how you can walk. You can hardly go up the stairs. So women couldn't run. Women couldn't climb a tree. Women were swept away simply because of what they were wearing. But here is why we were crying. Because then one of the Muslim leaders in Aceh was asked, what caused the tsunami? The immorality of women. Women whose sarong had come loose in the water and were found in their underwear. Dead. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, doesn't that make it right?
Yeah.
It is just unimaginable. But again, I don't want to insult the man in the audience, but it's a total male point of view. You know, no way to even imagine what these women went through. And then sleeping in the dark, that's my favorite. That was at the beginning in January. Any of you heard about the newest fatwa in Egypt? About sleeping in the dark? No? Well, in Egypt there was this big riot going on in January, because one of the Muslim scholars came out with a fatwa. And we all know what a fatwa is, right? Remember the legal advice that you can remember. Yesterday I gave you the example of the heart transplant. It's yes or no, and you can choose which one you take. Well, again, seeing moral decay all around him, this scholar brought out a fatwa ordering husbands and wives to sleep in the dark and to only do it in the dark so that they could never see each other. and then what you see is that societies are changing. Because suddenly Egyptians said, what's the man talking about? This is ridiculous. This is something between men and women, husband and wife. It's none of his business. So it fell flat. But again, you know, this whole morality issue, the fact that he feels he should bring out to the world this, you know, think about, we don't have comparable people, Billy Graham maybe, telling us to sleep in the dark and only do it in the dark. You see, that it's just, so you see the society has advanced still. It fell flat, nobody cared. And we can go, and I already told about kissing in public. And so when women do read the Quran, you'll get all kinds of very interesting byproducts. First of all, they can educate other women about it. Secondly, they change mindsets and cultures towards women. They debunk myths, the myths of how the brain, you know. You can easily debunk that now with medical research, can't you? And they start to become activists for women's rights, but also for children's rights. Also for the rights, as I say, of non-Muslims. Also for the rights of people like as homosexuals, because you know that's a big issue in the Middle East. In Egypt, people are jailed for being openly homosexual. In Iran, they're executed. You see, and again, that's what the extremists want. They want to go back to those laws, execute them, kill them. Actually, the most disturbing what do you call it, statement made in the Netherlands lately was by an imam. He was Dutch. He was a convert who said that homosexuals should be thrown from apartment buildings. Uh-huh. That did it, I tell you. I mean, everybody was shocked into their toes, we say in Dutch, because how can you say such a thing? But it also empowers women. They will no longer be silent. And they also start to work in areas of human rights, peacemaking. They start to stir up trouble and they start to question situations and start to say, wait, you cannot do this. And that's what's happening in Aceh, for example. Women go there and they question the rules that the men have made in the name of Islam and say, okay, tell me, where is this rule in the Quran, in the tradition, in the explanations, in the interpretations of the Quran? And they can't tell them. They don't know. They say, it's in the books. Yeah, which books? We know those books. Tell us. They can't answer. You see? So that is the problem with the Sharia and extremists. They make up rules as they go. And they make you believe that those are based on holy texts. But if you know they're not, you're a very dangerous person. Okay, I forgot how many that we see so far. So this is one of the rebel rousers. She's the worst of all. Because she has a Quran school where she teaches an average of 800 girls a year. And they all come out as feminists, activists, and more. And she has actually made a lot of interpretations of her own about women in the Quran. And that's what she, and she is the teacher of the girl we saw, of the girls we saw preparing in the beginning. And she also, she did the unthinkable. When she was younger, she was forced to marry a Muslim leader, and then he decided he wanted a second wife, and she ran away. But that was unthinkable. She ran away and became an auto mechanic in Jakarta. Oh, she said, I need a trade. And then, via, she started to attend Quran lessons and learn the Quran by heart. And after a long time, she could go back home, and her family then helped her to set up the Quran school. But she stayed unmarried. Actually, she said my big luck was he had a car accident when he was 30. He died very young. And so she stayed unmarried for a long time. And when I came back last year, and I phoned her, and I said, how are things? She said, did you hear it? I threw a bomb on the neighborhood. I said, what do you mean? She said, I married someone 20 years my junior. He cannot lord it over me. So you see, it is the revolutionary phase of Islam is very unexpected. We can see some more women. This is Fatima Mernissi. I thought maybe you have heard of her. Has any of you heard of her? She is someone from Morocco, and she has written a lot of books actually wondering why are the rules about women the way they are. And so she started, you know, and she did not read the Quran herself. She had scholars reading certain parts for her, and then she would write them in those books. And we can go on to the next one. Because of her, let's go to the next one. Because of her, in Morocco, the Muwaddana is the family law. It has completely changed, and it is now the most liberal family law in the Islamic universe, and it has the most protection for women. For example, in that family law, it says that a wife can apply for a divorce, which is actually against the Muslim rules, because according to Islam, the man can give a divorce whenever he wants, but a wife cannot get a divorce whenever she wants. Here it says a wife can apply for a divorce anytime she wants. It also says that a man is forbidden to take a second wife without the express consent of his first wife given in front of a court of law. Mm. Mm-hmm. So you see, they are actually overruling what is in the Quran. Mm-hmm. And so that is, people like Fatima Mernissi brought that whole process in, you know, in motion. Okay, I'm not sure how many I still have here. Maybe should we? We have still 5 minutes. Here is Rifat Hassan. She's from Pakistan. Well, you all know that Pakistan, you have this reintroduction of Islamic law. Again, mostly because of, you know, they wanted to subdue the women. It's mostly women suffering from that law.
And Rifat Hassan then started to decode, where do these rules or this mindset, where does it come from? And she realized it comes from the Adam and Eve story. And the idea that Eve was created from Adam's rib, and the idea that Eve was the one who sinned and then caused the fall. Now, is that in the Quran? No, it's not. The fall is not in the Quran. Adam and Eve are in the Quran, but they both sinned. Both, equally. And they were equally kicked out.
Give me one of those.
And yeah, and Muslims say, look, they would have been kicked out anyway, because paradise was like, you know, preschool. They needed to go to the real school of the world anyway, eventually. So she is the one who really brought home the awareness, like we have read the Quran with Jewish and Christian eyes here.
Yeah.
You see, all these Jewish myths and Christian myths and all this building up in the society surrounding Islam and where Islam moved in, you know, it was used against women. That women are, you know, the majority of the inhabitants of hell. This is where it comes from. So you see, this, if you start to decode it, you find very interesting things. She also figured out that it is based on a hadith, which is a tradition, which is false. Because there are traditions that are true and the traditions that are false. And false traditions are playing all lies. And they were put into the body of knowledge by someone who could gain power or riches or who wanted to get, you know, who wanted to advance in the world. So he put in a tradition to benefit himself. Sorry, women didn't put in traditions like that. It's men. So you see, this is very important work. Yeah, we can go to the next one. I just wanted to show you Asma Barlas, Believing Women in Islam is a path-breaking book. The next one. And this is Amina Wadud. I thought you might like to see her. The one who caused this big stir with preaching. And you see Amina Wadud, she's American. She's African-American, born and raised in the United States. She covers her hair. Next to her is Asma Barlas, who is from Pakistan. She doesn't. So you see, this is also, there's lots of options that women can choose from. Yeah? And I just want to show you some people again. This is Lili Zakia Munir, is a full cousin of Abdurrahman Wahid, who used to be the president of Indonesia. And she has started a program to teach about women's rights in the Indonesian Quran schools for men.
Oh.
Yeah, she has started a huge program and made a curriculum, and she's training teachers that they teach the men in those Quran schools about how they can read the Quran in alternative ways. And she was one of the main speakers in Barcelona. Well, Lily, by the way, came to Valparaiso because she's a good friend of mine. And I had several Saudi students in the audience. They totally despised her, male Saudi students. Like, they just didn't take her serious. So this is just the fact that she was a woman, you see? But in Indonesia, things are changing. And in other places in the world, things are changing. So, yeah, I think we can go. Let's go on. Just some pictures. Yeah, we can. It gets too much otherwise. You know, we've all heard about the polygyny, the polygamy or polygyny. We've all heard about women having to cover themselves. We've all heard about child marriage. And you see what is happening is that the paradigm is changing. And that is why the more the paradigm is changing, and that's my point, the more extremist action we will see. And it will get more and more violent. We will have more violence before it gets less. Because what we are seeing is not us against them. That's what we think, and that's how it's being portrayed. No, it's inside Islam. There is this huge struggle going on of groups that want to progress and groups that want to go back, and you know, what state of mind do you want to be in? And the women are at the forefront, as I have said before, and we are just a byproduct. Why are we a byproduct? Because a lot of the ideas come from us, and that's why we are so dangerous, you see? But in fact, it is not about us. It is about
other Muslims to make sure that the Muslim communities don't disintegrate. I don't know if I have more pictures there. Oh, that's the girl that we, she passed, by the way. Mm-hmm. I went to the graduation and had great fun, and she passed. And here is just, you know, you have Islam Online, and there you now can ask women advice. And Islam Online is pretty fundamentalist. You know, Muslim Brother, where we've talked about the Muslim Brother several times, it's behind it is the Muslim Brothers. But they can't avoid it. They've got to give some women a voice on it, so they do. And this is the kind of, it's called the disappearing left hand. It's just to teach, it's one of these morality, it's a comic teaching morality, how to use your right hand and never your left hand. Because you know that, right? In Muslim countries, you cannot use your left hand. You know that, right? Yeah, it's very impolite to use your left hand to eat or to point at someone or to touch someone.
You're doing it to me right now.
Yeah, I'm here to do it. I know. And I just wanted to show you, you know, again, this whole spectrum. And this is Aya Hirsi Ali, right, the one that we've been talking about. And I just heard that the Dutch government has fallen because of the whole issue about her.
And by the way, the other thing that happened today, yeah? The women in Kuwait voted today for the first time.
For the Kuwait. They were forbidden to vote, women in Kuwait. So this is, again, a day like no other day. Wow.
Women in Kuwait.
Wow.
Let's see, I don't know if I have more pictures.
The Dutch government fell.
Let's see if I have more, if you want to stand down. Do I have more? Oh, this is the one who won the Nobel Prize winner. The Nobel Prize, what's her name now? From Iran?
Oh, yeah.
And she was the one when Khomeini completely turned back the clock on laws and rules about women, she was the one who started the fight. And she managed with people working with her, because, for example, the minimum age of marriage was deleted. Now, there is no minimum age in Islam, not for men, not for women, which meant that a 9-year-old could marry a 56-year-old.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. Okay, I don't need to explain more. That, she changed that. She went and fought that, and now the minimum age is back to 16. They changed it. They realized this is ridiculous. That again, the desire to follow the Quranic rules, it didn't make any sense in modern society. You see? And it only led to abuse. What's her name now? It will come to me. Keep going. And she, by the way, you see she has no veil. She did that on purpose. On purpose. She accepted that award without the veil. Just to show you women praying with the kids in between. And that's it. Thank you.